Basically, we believe what would happen is, at least from my distant perspective now, exactly what did happen. That the company's assets, whatever was of value, would gradually be transferred out of that community, and the business would be left to languish. And White Furniture had an incredible name in the industry. Virtually all of the major, take someone like Henredon, which is a competitor of us. All the principals of Henredon had worked at White Furniture. Almost all of the major high quality case goods, is what they call it, hard furniture, had worked at White Furniture. It was the granddaddy of the furniture industry in North Carolina. And so it had this reputation of being right up there on the very top end in terms of quality, which is something, you can't create that. That comes from quality craftsmanship and materials and a long history. They just destroyed it.
Then why close a company like that has a reputation like that? What would be their motivation for buying a company like that and closing it? Would it be immediate profit?
Upstream the cash? I mean, I don't have the facts to ascribe bad motive. All I have was the history. I never met Clyde Engel. I never met with him.
But I realize I'm asking for speculative, for you to speculate a little bit.
Well, we felt like they could take the inventories out. That the inventories. Have you got the facts on what the final purchase price? I know we were offering more money.
I think I have the purchasing price somewhere in.
I've heard around 5 million.
Yeah, I want to say somewhere between 4.5 and 5, with several contingencies. I mean, the way these transactions work is you have someone who comes in, they make a purchase price, and they have adjustment potentials. And so I would bet that by the time it was all adjusted out, that they had paid well under 5, maybe between 4 and 5. And so our offer had come in somewhere in the $6 million range, which we could do only because we had tax-favored financing. I mean, banks who make loans on employee buyouts were able to get a tax-free interest on half of their interest. So you can get loans for that kind of situation that is prime minus one instead of prime plus two. So there are real benefits. And really what people were having to choose between was the fear of the unknown with the employee buyout versus the fear of the unknown with what looked like a corporate raider buying. And it was a pretty awkward situation. And the fear of continuing on as they were, which looked pretty...
But you also implied that maybe some implicit promises or suggestions were made to Sam White.
Well, they kept him on. They fired him a month or two after the buyout.
Right. Do you know what they said to him?
I don't know specifically. I mean, Zan would probably know. I mean, Sam told me at your open house. He says, they fired me right after it.
Sam has told me this story sort of off the record, not that it was off the record, but in the Bird's parking lot one day, standing across from the plant, which was kind of a pretty powerful place to hear this story, and has agreed to go on record and tell us the story. But we sort of have wanted to wait a little bit and talk to some folks.
Sam is really the tragic figure in all of this. I mean, he's the person that is good-hearted. He cared about the community. I think he wanted to do the right thing. He himself was right smack in the middle. He was heir apparent. He's the one that people were saying, the Millenders were saying, we don't have faith that he can run it. And if my memory is accurate, that his stock and his votes were the swing vote between yes or no, he's going to have a lot of revisionist history incentive. I mean, it's going to be a terrible, horrible burden for him to carry. that he casts the deciding vote. I mean, it's like Pilate, you know, it really is.
Did he express any regret to you at the opening when he said that they had fired him?
We didn't have a very long conversation. I think it was, people saw me as being a very strident voice of purity and clarity. I mean, I think that would be the perception. I mean, I had mentioned to Bill, I went to Steve White at the open house, and he didn't recognize me. But his wife, who had been working in the plant at that time, she says, "Oh, I know you. I remember you exactly. You were the lawyer from Durham. You were the first one to find what these guys were all about." So I think there is now a pariah, a prophetic sense among the folks who still remember, who were there, that this was what we said would happen, and it happened. And that they were... Look, go ahead.
Did you talk to Sam White directly? And did he inquire as to what his place might be if the employee buyout were to succeed?
As I recall, we were completely clear and candid from the front end that we were bringing in Crawford. Crawford would be chief executive, and we felt like there was a strong role for Sam in the business, but not as the CEO. We were really, if there was anything, that was our, if you're thinking about how these transactions are done, that was a difference for us. We were far more candid than people who are experienced are. They just simply do not reveal what their intentions are until they have control, and then they do whatever they damn well please. So I don't remember there being any discussion that he would be fired or that he would be kept. He would not, there was never any discussion that he would be the president, CEO. Crawford was going to be that person. Crawford was a stronger person, stronger.
When you made your presentation before the stockholders, was the vote that was taken whether or not the company should be sold to Clyde Engel's group or financed through the credit union, or was it in fact simply a vote?
Credit union didn't exist then.
Okay.
Self-help credit union did not exist.
Okay. What I'm getting at is, was it a vote between them or you, or was it a vote whether or not they would move forward with them, and if not, you would then have a chance to make your offer available and begin to negotiate? And that wasn't really clear to me.
I think the procedural vote was whether or not to merge with Hickory Chair. That was the official vote. I think these were the only two options out there, but I don't think that had the vote gone 51-49 the other way, it would not have been a vote to do. Basically, these were the two options that were on the table, but they could have decided. I think there was certainly still room to decide we don't want to do the Clyde Engel transaction and we don't want to do this one. But it had pushed to a point that those were the only two live options that were out there.
But your offer was on the table and there, and it could have.
Yeah,
had their offer been rejected, yours could have come to the table for a vote subsequently. Is that offer still available? Is it in written form? Is it something that we might?
Well, I had everything in my file. I just don't know whether I still have it. I mean, I had files from this and four or five equally compelling cases, and I just cleaned them out. I mean, I just threw a bunch out, and I don't know whether I still have it or not. Other people might have it.
Or any notes or tapes of your actual presentation and theirs on that day?
There are no tapes that I know of, unless they have them. The lawyers might. I mean, we had notes, because basically what was going on is there was a series over, let's say, a two-month period before that vote. There were legal maneuvers of saying, okay, here are the bylaws. How can we challenge this process? Because it was a cash-out merger is a hostile takeover. It's basically saying, if you don't buy in at this point, if you're a dissenting shareholder, you have certain rights that a court can do. But you lose certain benefits if you don't buy in right now. And if you get more than 51%, you can force everyone else to sell out. And so we were, I mean, that was, for me, was a new thing. I was saying, how in the hell can it be legal that if a large number of people do not want this to happen, that they can be forced not only to have it be sold, but to give up what they've owned for over 100 years? It just seemed outrageous to me. I now am less outraged by that piece of it, because there are situations with businesses where you need to not have, if you think about divorces in families, and you said, well, you guys just simply have to live with each other for the rest of your life, no matter how much you hate each other, you would destroy homes, and in this case, you would destroy businesses and people's jobs, that sometimes it's better to have one demon in control than having a divided house. But we were doing all kinds, it was all kinds of parliamentary, and we looked at getting a law firm to do what's called a tender offer, which is where you go directly to the shareholders to buy their stock in advance of them being able to vote it, so we could vote. We simply were not substantial enough financially to win a battle against someone who had acquired 100 corporations in his tenure. It was David fighting Goliath.
Was this project ever discussed with the workers, or ever?
Well, there were several meetings that we had with sort of the leadership of the business, and I can still remember one which was really fascinating. I think it was telling, where someone, and I don't remember who it was, said to Crawford, he says, "And just what is it that makes you so interested and concerned about Mebane, North Carolina?" So there was the skepticism of an outsider whose motivations were not solely to make money. And that is a telling critique on the culture of America, that people are more trusted with outright self-interest than they are. Idealism or altruism of any sort is basically a distrusted commodity in our culture. People cannot, if you know that someone is after it for greed, then you can at least trust that you understand it, but the other you can't. Crawford met, we met with virtually all the different financial and product people to try to assess what the product lines were. Our determination was we had to be comfortable that the business could be viable before it was worth spending all this time and energy to, and not to mention the employees' livelihoods. That was a pretty heavy responsibility for us to be saying, okay, it's a fair amount of hubris and arrogance. You don't do that lightly, at least not for people like us. Our sense was, if this can't work with a 95% confidence level, we don't want to do it.
So essentially,
we were that confident. We were that confident that it could be a viable, long-standing, profitable business in Mebane. I still am. But you have to have leadership that's committed to that.
But to your knowledge, this idea was never circulating on the shop floor amongst the workers.
I'm sure it got out. No, I'm sure that...
But never formally in any way.
I don't remember ever having a big, 500-person meeting, but there were a lot of people. I feel certain that people knew, in the way that rumors are within a plant, that they knew of these two options. And my guess is that they were equally concerned. I would bet that at the workforce level, they either didn't know, they didn't know much about either one, because businesses, when they're going through a sale and a fight among shareholders, they don't usually try to enlist their employees because there's the perception that that would scare them. For us, we had it as a condition of the offer that there would have to be a process of presentation to every department and a vote by a majority of the employees before we do it. It's ludicrous to have an employee-owned business where the employees have not had a chance to say they wanted it or didn't want it. I don't remember it ever getting that far.
Did you have any sense of how strongly the White and Milner families felt about the legacy of White Furniture and selling to a company that would, in fact, keep the company alive? Was this something that came to the table in terms of Hickory Chair's presentation, i.e., you know, we're going to buy this company to make a profit and to run and to continue White Furniture?
Well,
two questions there.
People want to believe what they need to believe to be able to do something. In this case, you had a company that had been identified with one town forever. But it had also passed through the generations, so the stock now was very dispersed. I mean, any family-owned company that lives three generations has, like, heir property to a farm, has 100 heirs now who have, as it cascades through the generations, a number of people, many of whom no longer lived in Nevin. And so those folks did not have the tie to Nevin. My perception of the Milliners, again, I never had a direct conversation with them at all, was that was a false choice. That their perception was, this business will not succeed if it continues the way it was. I think they were overly panicked, but I also understand if they had grown up and they made an assessment that Steve White or Sam White or someone could not lead this into the next decade, that their choice or their view was that it either they got the value that they could do and they could put it back, you know, do whatever they were going to do, or there was no value for anyone. Clearly, Steve White and Louise White and that piece of the family had strong feelings about what this meant. For them, they wanted it to continue as it was, as the as the legacy of Mevin. The question is, how do you do that? And I think when Hickory Chair came in, I can't remember the consultant's name, but there was an industry consultant who is paid a commission to bring about the sale and combination of companies like this, who was an industry known, respected person who basically said you should sell it to Hickory Chair. They've got the expertise to add value and keep it. He also had an incentive to say that. I mean, that's his how he got paid. And so I think folks like the Milliners and others, no one wanted to believe the information that we were presenting to them. I mean, it was like this, you know, Hickory Chair is well known. What about, Clyde Engel? That was a real confusing point. But when you are seeing the righteousness of your path, it's hard to get distracted from it. Hard to let the facts pull you away. And so I think people had a strong psychological need on all camps to feel like they were doing the best thing, doing the right thing. There was the good Southern moral. And I don't believe among the shareholders on either side that there were camps that I would say were malicious. There were honest disagreement about what is the right thing. And yes, people may have viewed the facts differently, but I don't view the Milliners as being the bad guys here. I think they did what they believed would produce value for them personally, and that would create the best opportunity for the business to continue in Mevin. We believed in good faith that they were operating in good faith, but that they were making the wrong choice. That within 5 to 8 years, the business would be milked and shut down.
Now, had the how are we doing on time?
We're bad. Yeah.
Do we need to wrap it up?
Yeah. What we really do is 12:22. I thought I've got to be.
Well. Okay. Great. It's been a fabulous interview.
We can wrap it up that quickly.
Yeah. I'm sorry. I didn't realize we had...
I just looked at my watch as well. So.